Birds in general really capture our attention with their calls and songs and with their often striking plumage. While we often notice that they're here for maybe part of the year and gone for other months, we may not think about how important it is not only to maintain their habitats here, but in other parts of the country or even the world. Plus, there are threats to them coming not only from man-made issues or natural changes, but also from competing species. We're going to talk about the Kirtland's warbler today as part of our series of programs marking the 40th anniversary of passage of the Endangered Species Act. Kim Grevels is an avian ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us today, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And Sam Jonas has done extensive nest monitoring and field work on Kirtland's warblers. He is a wildlife technician with the DNR. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks for having me.
So the Kirtland's warbler, you know, we had our usual Memorial Day bird show on Monday, and we talked about warblers a little bit. But Kim, why don't you just give us a quick overview of warblers in general and the Kirtland's? First of all, where did the name Kirtland's come from?
Well, the Kirtland's warbler is a species that was first discovered in 1851, and it was named for Jared T. Kirtland, who was a naturalist in the state of Ohio. He was the first to develop a bird checklist for that state. And to honor his great knowledge and his teachings, they named this new species that was the first specimen was collected in Ohio, so they named it after Jared T. Kirtland. And a lot of people wonder where the name comes from, and it's just named after this fellow.
Kind of a way to honor his work.
Yes. And this species was very secretive. The specimen that was collected then was taken during migration in Ohio. It was another 50 years before anyone knew where the bird nested.
Wow.
And they found the first nest just outside of Oslo, Michigan. And in the next 50 years, all subsequent nests that were found within 10 counties of that first nest.
Wow, so a very focused habitat.
Very small breeding range for this species. And they spend their winters in the Bahamas, and they don't go anywhere else. So they have a very narrow wintering range as well. And that kind of places certain risk, if you will, on a population, because they're confining themselves to a very small geographical area during the breeding season, also during the wintering mm-hmm. season, and then they become susceptible to disease outbreaks or to catastrophic events such as a major storm.
Right, and I'm thinking, you know, somewhere in the Bahamas could have a hurricane go through and affect their habitat, and, you know, when they come back, it's not there.
That could happen. I mean, we hope it doesn't,
right.
It could happen, and there's not much we can do about that, but with the warblers population recovering as management is being done in Michigan on their breeding range, as the population begins to expand outwards, that relieves that pressure on them just a little bit. If we can get some really good breeding populations established here in Wisconsin and some more up in Ontario, other parts of the range where their habitat occurs, then they're a little bit more protected from that kind of event.
And Sam, what is it about, for instance, that small area in Michigan and now the places that they're nesting in Wisconsin? What do those areas look like? What kind of trees are there? Is it heavily covered or is it open?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the Kirtland's warbler is a specialist in habitat, and they specialize in jackpine habitat, an extensive area dominantly made up by jackpines and pine barrens. So there's a mixture of jackpines and some red pines and pine barrens, and they nest in typically blueberries underneath jackpines about 5 to 20 years of age, and they typically grow, you know, a foot a year, so they're about 5 to 20 feet high is the trees that they pick. Biologists aren't exactly sure why that is. However, we do believe that they target 5 to 20 year old jackpines because the lower branches are still alive at that age, and they nest underneath that for overstory cover.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, I mean, when you said specialists, they are very specific, not just any pines, but jackpines, mm-hmm. not just any jackpines, but a certain age.
Correct.
That too seems to go back to what Kim was saying, that it wouldn't take much for them to really be thrown off.
Correct.
Wow. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Kirtland's warblers as part of our endangered Endangered Species Act series, and you can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or if you've been lucky enough to get a picture of a Kirtland's warbler, post that on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. I'm Judith Sears Poisson sitting in for Larry Mealer. So the Kirtland's warblers are considered to be a conservation reliant species. Kim, what does that mean and why are they specifically designated as that?
Well, their habitat was traditionally dependent upon fire to regenerate the jack pine and make younger jack pine barrens for them. And we had a campaign in the 20th century, the Smokey the Bear campaign, that was very successful in suppressing wildfires, which is a good thing. But it also and resulted with less young jack pine, you know, being regenerated. Wow. And so the researchers in Michigan back in the 1950s and 60s realized that the habitat was disappearing on the landscape. So they developed methods for how to regenerate jack pine through artificially opening the serotonous cones that normally would be opened by fire. They used heat, and it took them a while to develop a successful process for being able to propagate and plant jack pine seedlings. But they finally succeeded in the 1960s with doing that, and they started to create lots of habitat. In the early 1970s, there was a census done, and the population was found to consist of just 167 singing males. And to get the total population estimate, you double that, assuming there's 50-50 makeup of males and females. So it was less than 350 birds in the whole population in the world. And it had been at 1,000 singing males in 1961. So that was a big drop in population. And they had been creating more habitat. So what was going on? Mm-hmm. Well, they realized that the brown-headed cowbird was having the impact on the population more so than loss of habitat at that point.
And people that were listening to our birdwatching show on Monday, we actually talked about cowbirds, and there was and still is a picture up on our Facebook page of a sparrow's nest with a cowbird egg in it, and it's very clearly it's kind of like that one of these things is not like the others, you can tell right away. And we talked a little bit about cowbirds and how they're the only parasitic bird in North America, meaning they deposit their eggs in other birds' nests to allow them to be raised. But I think that people think, oh well, you know, one more bird, you know, what difference does it make? But it makes a huge difference for a bird like the Kirtland's warbler. They're little birds, and cowbirds, but even babies can be much bigger. So what kind of impact does, say, a cowbird laying or cowbirds laying their eggs in Kirtland's nests have?
Well, the cowbird can have a significant impact on the Kirtland's warbler population, and it did have a significant impact. With the absence of control of cowbirds, the workers in Michigan found that as many as 60% of all nests get parasitized. The Kirtland's is particularly vulnerable. They have no way to recognize that the egg is not their own, or that even the chick is much bigger and different looking than their own. They just don't recognize it. And the bigger chick is more aggressive. It hatches earlier, and it gets the food, to the peril of the young of the Kirtland's warbler. And so they end up raising a cowbird chick instead of their own. And a population can quickly go into decline when they're not raising their own young and reproducing themselves. And that's what happened in the 1960s and 70s. And so at that point, the Michigan team introduced cowbird trapping in addition to setting habitat goals of having 30,000 acres of young jack pine suitable habitat on the landscape at all times. And they reached that goal of the habitat by the mid-1980s, and then we started to see the population recover. The numbers really bounded back. And with the cowbird control and in combination with the habitat management is what's believed to be responsible for that. They continue to do cowbird control in Michigan to this day. Mm-hmm. And they know that even though the population has recovered to the goal they set for the population, it has exceeded that goal, if they take the bird off of the Federal Endangered Species Act, the money, the funding for doing the management, the cowbird control and the habitat management will go away. And so they're working on a 10-year plan to get the species off the Federal Endangered Species Act by developing a sort of friends group that will do the fundraising.
To replace that,
to
those
replace
resources.
The federal money that pays for that management.
Okay.
And so we are working here in the state of Wisconsin, now that we have a breeding population here, we are working to get the state to list the bird as state endangered. Mm-hmm. And that will give it the extra protection it needs because the population here is so small.
Okay. I want to go back to the phrase cowbird cowbird management, I think,
yes.
was what you said.
Yes.
Sam, what does that mean exactly? You spend a lot of time in the field and, mm-hmm. and you do nest monitoring, so I'm assuming that you were one of the people that would spot a cowbird egg. Mm-hmm. And what do you do then? What happens with that egg? What happens with the adult cowbirds that are obviously in the area and happily depositing their eggs in other birds' nests?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I did discover a cowbird egg in the nest, I generally... Every year we try something different, and this year we were being extra sensitive with our monitoring and weren't approaching the nests prior to hatching.
Hmm.
That way we reduce chances of predation and things like that in the nest, so we wouldn't approach it. So by the time I realized if there was a cowbird in there, they're already hatched anyway at this time. So we didn't do anything to remove any of the cowbirds. However, what we do to prevent the chance of that happening is work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife wildlife specialists, and they set up cowbird traps. We had 3 cowbird traps set up last year, and a wildlife specialist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife monitors that. So that's what he does, and every week he's out there checking the traps.
And how do you lure an adult cowbird into a trap?
Well, they're large traps, and originally it's sort of a small house. It's like a wooden-looking little shack,
okay.
with nets. And originally you put in some sticks and camouflage it a little,
okay.
bit, and you put in cowbird decoys. That originally lures the cowbirds to the trap. And
because they think there's a party going on.
Exactly. And there's some food in there, too. So yeah, it is a party a little bit. But so once you get a few cowbirds in there, you generally keep them in there so you have some live decoys. And
mm-hmm.
then everybody flocks once they see the party going on. So.
Okay. And then, so you trap some adults, and then are they just relocated, or what happens with them?
Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife handles that side. So... they humanely euthanize the cowbirds.
Okay. And cowbirds are pretty much all over, right? I mean, they're kind of an issue wherever they are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some species that they're obviously putting their eggs in the nest and it's not as big a deal, like especially like the non-native sparrows and things like that. But they really are. I mean, they've really developed a pretty good skill of staying, keeping their populations up and using other birds to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've evolved to specialize in that. And even out in the field, I've noticed it, watching Kirtland's warblers, the female cowbirds, you see them around in the area, they sit on top of the trees and they're just looking for action, and then they go dump their eggs. So,
and is there a reason that they like putting their eggs in a warbler nest, or will they just pretty much take any nest that's around?
They pretty much would take any nest that's there.
Oh. How many eggs, is there an average number of eggs that the Kirtlands themselves are laying in, and do they have one or more broods in a year?
They have one brood a year. However, they will re-nest. So if their first nest failed, they will... and it's early enough, the couple will go and attempt a re-nest. So I've been finding, Kim, you can help me with this too, but I think they average about 4 to 6 eggs in a nest.
Correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might have 4 or 6 of their own young,
mm-hmm.
but then there might be... Do cowbirds generally only leave one egg in a nest, or...?
You know, I'm not sure.
Okay. But they might have one big cowbird baby and then
right.
5 of their own that are all competing for food.
Right.
It's
right.
typically one egg, but it can be 2 or 3 eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, of course, the more eggs, the less survival you get
mm-hmm.
with
mm-hmm.
the host species.
Sure. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. We are talking about Kirtland's warblers as part of a series of programs marking the 40th anniversary of passage of the Endangered Species Act. If you'd like to join in the conversation, if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Amanda Magnus is our on-air producer today on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about Kirtland's warblers. They're a species that were traditionally found mostly in Michigan, but they have been establishing nesting grounds here in Wisconsin, and there are a lot of folks that are working hard to help them do that. And Sam, you had you wanted to add something about the partnership on the cowbird.
Yeah, with issue. The partnership with the cowbird, the trapping issue was covered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and not the U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
So the USDA, so. Great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at one point, I mean, I think when we hear the word warblers, we think of singing, and we do have audio of the Kirtland's warbler song. So let's take a listen to that. So that's the Kirtland's warbler. Kim, what stands out about that song for you? Or is that a song or a call?
That's their song.
Okay.
And it is a kind of a simple song.
It is, which all of a sudden, that's why I was thinking maybe that's actually their call.
Yeah, no, that's their song. And I think it's a very distinctive song. Like most warblers, it's short and it has a variety of staccato sounds as well as some trill mm-hmm. to it. And it's because it's so distinctive, it most of the time does not sound like any other bird. And so when you're out in the habitat and you hear that, it's just a standout from the other birds.
And I bet it's kind of a thrill, too, because they aren't that common, even though they've really been making good progress. There's still, what's the estimate of how many pairs now and how many do we have in Wisconsin?
Well, for this year, we're still figuring that out. But last year, we had 21 singing males counted for the state of Wisconsin.
Wow.
And we had, I believe it was 11 females at the main breeding site and 11 nests that were discovered. There could have been more there and we just didn't find
mm-hmm.
them. But that's been the numbers for the last couple of years. This year we're seeing a little bit more at the breeding site. We think we have a higher count of singing males and the females are still coming in.
Mm. And Kim, you were saying that when they were first discovered or detected in Ohio and then in Michigan, it actually, even though people knew they were there, it took a while to figure out where they were nesting because they are so secretive. So, Sam, when you're doing nest monitoring, are you listening for that song? Is that what kind of cues you in that you're in the right place and then you can kind of try to figure mm-hmm. out where they're going?
Definitely. The males are sort of my go-to guys. They show me they show me where to look. And my job when I originally showed up for the job was to find those singing males. They're the first to arrive to the site, and they're trying to establish their territories.
Mm-hmm.
So right away, they're singing a lot, they're moving around a lot, and I try and nail down each individual's location. Once I do that, the females are coming in, and they pair up, and the males are still singing, and they'll sing on top of the nest. They will bring food to the female while she's nesting, and that's sort of how I key in on the nest.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And so are they particularly territorial, or, you know, how much are they trying to make their presence known in a particular area?
Big time. They're really territorial birds. They're singing a lot, like I said, and they will pretty much fight any bird that comes into their territory. I mean, chickadees, other sparrows, any other warblers, they're kind of trying to kick them out of there. So, yeah, they're really dominant
wow.
in their territories.
Wow. Well, Nancy in Big Slats actually had a question about tracking and finding the nest. So let's go to Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Hi, you guys.
Hi.
I wanted to let you know you just answered my question, and I phrased it before you started answering. Humph. I wanted to know how you track or find the possible nests for the Kirtland warblers.
And so kind of following up on Nancy's question and what you were saying, Sam, you know, are you ever able to just spot a nest without kind of triangulating it with the male, or are they so well hidden that you really need that extra help?
You really need the extra help. I mean, there's always a chance that you could, but slim to none. And also, again, with these birds being federally endangered, you got to be really careful. I mean, you got to watch your feet, watch where you're going, and just, again, watching the males is really the best way to do it, and they help a lot.
And what material are they using to make the nest primarily?
Well, it's made up of a lot of moss and blueberries and sort of dead materials, just like any other bird, mostly.
And so they're nesting under the branches of the jack pines, but are they using material from the jack pines themselves?
No, not typically. They're usually found underneath blueberry branches, so they're really concealed underneath blueberry bushes and under jack pine branches.
It really makes me nervous for them, thinking about how very specific that is, and it just seems like it would take so little to throw them off.
Yeah, and one thing that really impressed me was, you know, they winter in the Bahamas, and the same bird will come back to the same territory the next year, and a lot of times they'll nest within 5 feet of their nest last year. So amazing.
They're creatures of habit.
Yeah.
They vacation in the same place. They come back to the same place. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to Jeff in Superior next. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning. I really celebrate all creatures, great and small. We really do share this planet with a wonderful variety of animals. This particular bird interests me because I often camp in northern Wisconsin over near Bayfield, Madeline Island, that area. It seemed to be a natural habitat for this bird. Am I right?
Yes, that is an area where we do find a singing male or two almost every year since we've been doing the surveys. We started doing them in the year 2008. And they do show up at sites over there. There's lots of available habitat. We keep hoping they will get a population established there, a breeding population, but it hasn't happened yet that we can find.
All right, thanks for that call. And you can join in with your questions or comments by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you been fortunate enough to see or hear a Kirtland's warbler? We'd love to hear from you. And also, we'd love to hear from you if you've been involved in any efforts, either nest monitoring or banding of this or other endangered birds that we worry about and try to help. I also want to let all of you know that we will be talking with folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center today at 11:45 about biogas as a sustainable alternative fuel. So I hope you'll stay tuned. Now, one of the other ways, I know that there was some exciting news about a male showing up in Marinette County last week, and that was a male that had been tagged as being in that area. Tagging, I mean, if they're that hard to spot and to find, how in the world do you go about tagging them? And they're tiny. We actually have some pictures up on the Facebook page from a Flickr site. I think it's the Fish and Wildlife Service Flickr channel. And there's a series of photos of the Kirtland's warbler. And one of them is actually banding a Kirtland's warbler. And the bands are tiny and their little legs are so tiny. So how do you tag them, Sam?
Very carefully.
I set you up for that one.
Yeah. No, we set up mist nets, they're called. And they're really thin, and you can hardly see through them, but there's a net there. And it's probably about 20 to 30 yards long. And you set them up in a row of jack pines, and you play a calling of a Kirtland's warbler. And like I said before, they're really territorial. So they're like, hey, there's another Kirtland's in my area. They come check it out. We put up a decoy in the mist net, and they come in and swoop in and get caught in the net, and very carefully extract them from the net that they're caught in and go ahead and band them.
And so what is the information that's contained on the bands, and how does that then help you in future monitoring?
Well, they're color-coded, so that's how we record that. And really, they help me, you know, identify the bird, what bird returned, maybe last year's bird didn't return this year, or a new bird is in a new territory. And also, if an unbanded bird shows up, then we know a new bird is here. Mm-hmm. So that's something that can be exciting for us.
And the colors denote, say, that they were in a particular area, like maybe what year they were banded. What do the colors mean to you?
Well, that's how I identify them. So I name them after their colors. And I guess that just lets me track them. So maybe one day AROB isn't here today and next day somewhere else. So that's just how I track them.
Okay. Well, let's go to Thomas in Manitowoc. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. I just tuned in a little while ago, so I hope you didn't discuss this yet, but I was wondering if there's any located up in the Spread Eagle Barrens area.
And that's in Marinette County, and we do have a bird that has returned to Marinette County forest land this year. And that bird was banded at the same site where it has occurred this year, and that's the only male that has been found so far. But our survey continues until June 15th.
So there may be more.
There may be more. There could very well be more.
Thomas, have you spotted or heard a Kirtland's warbler?
No, I haven't, but that area up there is managed for songbirds, and I really enjoy walking around the different areas by Spread Eagle and the Barrens there, because there's a lot of unique birds up there, and it's one area that really doesn't have a lot of people, so don't tell anybody.
Okay. Your secret is safe with the three of us, I promise. Well, and also, Thomas, if you just tuned in, you may not have heard the Kirtland's Warbler song that we played earlier, but I want to let people know the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is a really wonderful resource, especially online, because they have wonderful information about birds, and they also have audio of a great many birds. So you can go to the Cornell Lab for Ornithology website and find that song. And so if you train yourself to listen to it, maybe you will hear Kirtland's out there. So talking about the general public, is there a role for them to play in monitoring? One of the other Endangered Species Act programs that we did was actually all about citizen monitoring, and it seems like some projects and some species, there's a lot of opportunity and a real need for the public to get involved. Is there a role that just average people can play to help the Kirtland's warblers?
Well, our surveyors are people who have advanced birding skills, and they were selectively chosen to do the surveys because we need their skills in order to be able to determine if a bird is present. And we have such scarce resources that we don't want to be chasing down false reports. So we need to get reliable reports mm-hmm. from these surveyors. So we reserve that for people with advanced skills. But how people can get involved and really support the project is to participate in the new Great Wisconsin Birdathon. And that is hosted by the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin. It's a brand new program that the proceeds go to the Bird Protection Fund. Mm-hmm. And that's the fund that primarily supports the Kirtland's Warbler Project, and Great. It helps us to pay for nest monitoring and for the skilled labor that we need in order to do this very fine and difficult work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've talked about things that are going on here in Wisconsin and in the upper Midwest to help the Kirtland's. What about in the Bahamas, where they're spending a good chunk of the year? What kind of monitoring, if anything, is going on down there?
Well, the Nature Conservancy, who is one of our partners on the project, has a mist netting and banding project down on Eleuthera Island. It's one of 700 islands in the Bahamas. We know very little about where the Kirtland's warbler occurs in the Bahamas, what habitats they're using, what food do they eat. And there's a group of graduate students that the Nature Conservancy has recruited to run this project, and they capture about 25 to 30 Kirtland's warblers a year and band them. And we have had three of those warblers show up at our main breeding site, wow. and a fourth one show up in Marinette County. Wow. Since 2007, when we first discovered the breeding site.
Wow. And so the Nature Conservancy and other groups like that are really key in that collaboration. You've mentioned, both Sam and Kim, you've mentioned quite a few different partners. I mean, it seems like there are all these different roles to play and all these different organizations and agencies that are working together. Is that in large part why the Kirtland's warblers have made a pretty good comeback in the last decade or so?
Oh, definitely. The Kirtland's Warbler Recovery Team is a team of many different agencies and private industry as well as individuals that partnered starting back when the bird was first listed as endangered in 1973. And they have worked together as a partnership for all these years. Wisconsin has joined the recovery team now that we have a breeding population. And we have many partners within the state that help us to manage our little population and to do this project. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, has jurisdiction over this species because it is a federally mm-hmm. listed species. And so they have the lead, and then the DNR is the partner with them. And we mentioned Wildlife Services from the USDA. We also are very fortunate to have the partnership of Plum Creek Timber Company, on whose land the main breeding site exists.
Wow.
And they have agreed to do some management nearby for Kirtland's warblers. And in 5 to 6 years, we hope to have some new habitat available for these birds to move into as the habitat that they are in ages beyond its usefulness. So we're very grateful to them for that.
Wow. So we've got federal and state agencies. We have nonprofits like the Nature Conservancy, and the Natural Resources Foundation is a nonprofit that supports the DNR. And then we also have for-profit businesses. So, I mean, that seems like, in a lot of ways, that's kind of an ideal model.
And there's also the county forest folks.
Wow.
Who are also doing management up in Marinette. They have designated a whole area as Kirtland's Warbler Management Area, and they are planting trees, I think, beginning this year.
Wow. Yeah, that's really exciting. And I'm guessing that is not necessarily the case for all endangered species, that there's not that kind of a broad-based kind of collaboration going on.
Well, I do know that it exists for other mm-hmm. endangered species. Certainly the piping plover, they could say the same, name a lot of the same partners and say the same thing, that the partnership is what really drives the project. I suppose there are some species mm-hmm. that fall through the cracks mm-hmm. on that. And it really takes a lot of dedication on the part of people who are employed to do this work to bring those partnerships together, to hold them together and foster mm-hmm. them. And we are fortunate in that there has been a long, long history of researchers and wildlife biologists and other partners who have made a commitment to the species. Mm-hmm.
So, Sam, the Kirtland's warblers are only in a handful of Wisconsin counties right now. Mm-hmm. Are there other areas in the state that look like they could be possible Kirtland's habitats? And if there are, if you build it, they will come? Or do you have to kind of give them a little nudge in the right direction? I mean, how can the professionals working on this help them find more, expand their habitat?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is sort of like if you build it, they will come. We kind of do that.
The Jack Pine Forest of Dreams, is
exactly,
that it?
Yeah. So we're sort of reaping the benefits of Michigan and their success story. It's not like we planted Kirtland's warblers in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. they expanded their range into Wisconsin because we had the habitat, suitable habitat. So we have a second monitor that works, and they also not only monitor for singing males and other birds, but they're looking at habitat and seeing if maybe not this year, but next year, maybe it'll be suitable habitat and things like that. So, yeah, we are still discovering possible new places.
And they're also in Ontario now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
There are similar areas of habitat in Ontario that they can inhabit.
The same year that we discovered the nesting in Wisconsin, Ontario discovered a nest on a military base, and that has been a very small population. They have multiple nests now, I believe, and they have continued to return to that site. They ban their birds as well, and they have birds returning from the Bahamas each year. So we're hoping that that population will grow along with the Wisconsin population growing, and we'll see this bird expand. When we say expand their range, I think that historically the bird occurred throughout the range of the jack pine. And jack pine went from eastern Minnesota across the upper Great Lakes into Ontario. And that's where you can find suitable habitat for them. And I think it's sort of a reclaiming mm-hmm. of their former range is what's really happening with
them. So they're expanding back into
areas where they're
historical.
Right, because we have had Kirtland warblers, very infrequent reports of Kirtland's warblers, but all throughout the 20th century, a Kirtland's warbler was reported on rare occasion.
Okay. And so we're talking about them expanding their habitats in North America or in their nesting territories. Is there any hope of helping them expand in their wintering areas? Because you were saying that being, you know, in such a small area, obviously it makes them more vulnerable that way.
On their wintering range, they're trying to get enough information so that they can develop a conservation and management plan. They don't have enough information currently to make those kind of plans. Mm-hmm. There are over 700 islands to investigate, and this is tropical habitat. It's, you know, you need a machete to go through mm-hmm. it. And so how are you going to find this little bird that only is 5.5 inches in length and weighs less than 0.5 ounce? And how are you going to find this bird when it doesn't sing during the winter time and it's buried in this jungle? So it's very, very challenging.
It makes a needle in a haystack look pretty easy.
Right. Yeah. It does.
So they're obviously not living in jack pine forests when they're down in the Bahamas. So they're able to live in a very different climate and habitat in the winter, but then when they come back here, they're looking for very, very specific blueberries under jack pines that are 5 to 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's, mm-hmm. yeah. So there's, it's really encouraging to hear about such a broad collaboration and that it's working. I mean, I think that's a really big testament to the commitment of all of you that are working on the Kirtland Warblers Recovery Project. Is that right?
Well, there's the Kirtland's Warbler Recovery Team, which is the overarching team for the whole global population. And then in Wisconsin, we call it the Kirtland's Warbler Conservation and Management in Wisconsin.
Great. And if people want to find more information about Kirtland's warblers, about endangered species in general, we do have a link to the DNR site on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. But the DNR site in general is DNR, like Department of Natural Resources, .wi.gov, and then you can just search for any species that you're looking for. Quickly, in just the last minute or so, Kim, what are the next steps in helping these birds thrive in Wisconsin?
Well, we have had our partners begin with some management of habitat, creating new habitat on the landscape, and that's, I think, the way to go to ensure that we always have habitat of suitable age available for them right. in the areas where they are occurring. And I think continued monitoring so that we can observe when they begin nesting at a new place and then secure that site and do the management that's necessary. Mm-hmm. If we need cowbird control to implement it, some of the sites up north, we don't get a lot of cowbirds, and that won't be necessary. Mm-hmm. But there may be other things we would want sure. to do, such as find nearby places that we can plant more jack pine and promote their habitat so that they can stay in the area beyond the time when the habitat they're currently using gets too old for them.
Great. Well, Kim Grevels is an avian ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Thanks so much, Kim, for joining us today.
You're quite welcome. It was my pleasure.
And Sam Jonas has done extensive nest monitoring and field work with Kirtland's warblers. He is a wildlife technician with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Sam, it was a pleasure.
It was great. Thank you very much.
We are going to shift gears a little bit, but really, you know, we've been learning about how, you know, unexpected threats to habitat and the birds and other wildlife that we enjoy can have huge effects. And we are going to talk about trying to replace some of the fossil fuels that have severe impacts on our environment here and around the world with folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. We're going to talk about biogas and how that might be a renewable alternative to natural gas. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned.